This is Don Goddard with your news at noon. And the biggest news today is the swift decision of Britain's burly old warrior, Prime Minister Winston Churchill, and his resignation. That's by way of being a routine affair, of course, the operation of the method by which Britain governs itself. It's expected as an answer to the British Labour Party, which has indicated its unwillingness to continue in the coalition government. For a first-hand report of the situation, we take you to John McVane at the NBC microphone in London.
And now to NBC in London.
This is John McVane in London. Mr. Churchill today went through the traditional ceremony that precedes a general election in Britain. This morning he went to Buckingham Palace, told the king he was unable to continue in office, and offered his resignation. The king accepted the resignation of Mr. Churchill and his government, then immediately reappointed Mr. Churchill to continue as prime minister of an interim government until the election can be held. 2 hours, Mr. Churchill drove up to the palace for the second time, carrying with him the list of new ministers for the king's approval. All the Labour and Liberal Party cabinet members who've held office since May 1940 are now out of the government. It's expected Mr. Churchill will fill their places with some of the Conservative members he judges will best appeal to electors. It's expected the election will be held as soon as possible, probably on July 5th. Judging by the tone of the letters that Mr. Churchill, the Conservative leader, and Mr. Attlee, the Labour Party chief, have been writing to each other, the fight should be a bitter political battle. For the last year or two, the Labour Party has charged that Mr. Churchill was going to pull a snap election at the end of the war in Europe. They claim that his great personal prestige would be used in the moment of triumph to return a Conservative government to power for the next 5 years. Mr. Churchill, on the other hand, had announced that he was going to call for an election if the Labour Party refused to continue in the national government until the defeat of Japan. The Labour Party did refuse. Labour wanted the election to be held in the fall to give them a chance to reach members of the forces with their platform and to benefit by the psychological letdown after VE Day. Conservatives, however, were worried. Both parties feel that such a delay would mean a big swing to the left in British opinion, and the Conservatives might be overwhelmed in a Labour landslide. The recent loss of a couple of by-elections alarmed Conservative politicians. Mr. Churchill, one of the most astute of the lot, decided to counterattack before the Labourites could bring their guns to bear. So today, he dismissed his coalition government and prepared for a straight party fight. Because of Mr. Churchill's adroit move, it looks like anybody's battle, with only a slight margin one way or the other. An RAF sergeant I was talking with the other day expressed the reason the Conservative Party machine is worried. He said he'd voted Conservative all his life. He doesn't like the Labour program of nationalization of industry, but he's going to vote Labour in the coming election. He claimed that in his 6 years in the forces, the government hasn't done enough for the troops in pay, family allowances, cigarettes, entertainment, welfare, or preparation for a better post-war life. He blamed it all on the Conservative politicians who opposed such improvements in the House of Commons. He said he thought a Labour victory this time would force the Conservative Party to modernize itself and cut out its dead wood. The present House of Commons was originally elected 10 years ago. The national government has been in office 5 years, and nobody really knows how the country will vote. That could make it one of the most interesting elections on record, a barometer for Britain's future. This is John McVane in London, returning you to the NBC newsroom in New York.
Thank you, John McVane in London. That was the story of Prime Minister Churchill's resignation as Prime Minister this morning and his reappointment by the King to head an interim government until the general elections are held on July 5th. The story of Churchill's resignation has dropped other European news into the background for the moment, but there are a few significant items from abroad to report today. For one thing, a couple of Nazi war criminals, Göring and von Rundstedt, are back in the news today. Both of them, big fish, and they've been caught. They've been brought to Britain now, and reliable sources in London tell newsmen that Göring is being held at a hotel in northern England, the bridal suite, no doubt. The report is that Göring arrived in London some time ago and that he passed through the city unrecognized, perhaps because he wasn't covered with medals. Von Rundstedt was brought over from the continent at a different time, but he was recognized by railroad workers in the London station, and there was a nice chorus of whatever passes for Bronx cheers in London for that one-time Nazi general. But there's no information on where von Rundstedt is being kept right now, and neither is there any explanation of the reason for bringing the two Nazi war criminals to England. The reason might be that Göring and von Rundstedt are safer there. That is, there's less chance of some Nazi fanatics trying to rescue them. Then again, it might be that they'll be tried in London for their war crimes. But these are just guesses, and we'll have to wait for some official word. It appears the Allies are finally getting down to the business with these war criminals. Another example of this is a report from Supreme Headquarters in Paris today, a report that says all members of the acting German government in Flensburg have been taken into custody, finally, as formal prisoners of war. Also picked up on the same charges, this report says, have been all members of the German high command at Flensburg. Those arrested include 300 Nazi officers, as well as many prominent civilians. So now, at long last, we have Dönitz and his gang in jail where they belong. And in this connection, it's good to see Senator Barkley of Kentucky come out with a statement that he's in favor of swift and merciless punishment for war criminals, punishment to fit the crimes they committed against humanity. Moscow has been saying this all along, of course, has been saying that the Nazi menace should be eradicated without tears and without any more shilly-shallying. President Truman has decided to visit San Francisco and address the final session of the Security Conference. That has just been announced just a few moments ago by Secretary of State Stettinius after he had talked this morning to the president. He said that he was confident the conference would be wound up early in June, and he used the word successfully wound up, although he could not give the exact date. The White House has confirmed the story that appeared earlier in the newspaper PM today, or at least part of that story. President Truman has received and accepted the resignation of Attorney General Francis Biddle, and the president will make a formal statement to that effect at his news conference later this afternoon, around 4 o'clock. Whether the president requested the Attorney General's resignation is not confirmed. The resignation was submitted, along with other cabinet resignations, as a routine matter a few days after Mr. Truman took office. His determination to accept that resignation of the Attorney General had been a matter of Washington gossip for some time. Biddle, a member of an old and famous American family, started his public life as secretary to Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes. Since he took the cabinet post 4 years ago, he has built a reputation for an unrelenting defense of civil liberties and antitrust prosecution. He had tangled with Mr. Truman on numerous occasions, when the latter was a senator. They had differed, for example, on the reappointment of Maurice M. Mulligan of Kansas City as a United States District Attorney. Biddle was for it, Truman against it. Mulligan it was who prosecuted Thomas J. Pendergast for income tax violations and sent him to jail. And Pendergast, the boss of Kansas City, was one of Truman's first political supporters. There is some comment in Washington today over the other possible changes in the cabinet. For example, what about Secretary of State Stettinius? Will President Truman accept his resignation when the San Francisco conference is over? There had been some political pressure to replace Stettinius, motivated by the feeling that he is not a man of strong political stature. However, the talk in Washington is that Stettinius has done such a good job as chairman of the San Francisco conference and has made so many friends among the other nations out there that the president may find it difficult to replace him, that is, if he wanted to in the beginning. The magazine Newsweek takes the occasion today of President Truman's 40th day in office, that was on Monday, May 21st, to weigh a question that has been asked concerning Mr. Truman's direction as the nation's chief executive. Is he bearing to the right or is he leaning to the left? The magazine goes on to list President Truman's actions since he's been in office. He has announced that he favors the Bretton Woods program. He has endorsed the Roosevelt revised reciprocal trade program. He has backed the OPA and the stabilization program wholeheartedly. He has moved incisively to start reduction of the budget. He has come out flat-footedly against deferring agricultural workers. He has declared against any revision in taxes until Japan is licked. He has asserted that we must find a way to keep Europe from starving. On policy, then, he is standing almost where President Roosevelt stood. One important exception was the overriding of Elmer Davis in the OWI. The president held that General Eisenhower was right when he said a free flow of news, in other words, a free press, should be established in Germany as a matter as long as it was consistent with military security. And the news magazine also cites the appointments the president has made. Generally speaking, his appointments have been on the conservative side, yet all regular Democrats. The only exception in this case is the reappointment of David Lilienthal to head the TVA again. He's a new dealer. And on the other hand, the president has courted Congress, and his calendar of visitors, a very full one indeed, has contained few of the 100% new dealers. Now, however, comes more serious test in the matter of appointments. Biddle, of course, was an ardent new dealer. Stettinius is perhaps a little less of that color. On the face of it, one gathers that President Truman, without spectacular action and with great friendliness, is veering from the right of the line held by President Roosevelt. A glance at the Pacific War News shows the Japs still on the run on most battlefields. One of the late reports says that the last Jap stronghold in the Wewak area of New Guinea has now been captured with the fall of Cape Moen to Australian troops, and that American push through Unibaro is still going strong on the island of Okinawa as our doughboys spread out beyond the East Coast port. A new surprise attack made without artillery or tank support has seized the northern end of extensive enemy positions dominating Yonabaru Bay there on Okinawa, and this new gain put us in a spot where we dominate the bay entirely, which used to be a Jap fleet anchorage. And as the battle for Okinawa goes on, with the hope of our taking the island very soon, Allied air power is keeping up widespread attack on Jap shipping and on land targets. Medium bombers from the Philippines have struck at Formosa for the seventh straight day, and Radio Tokyo reports that our superfortresses are still laying mines in the waters of the Jap home islands. Meanwhile, our troops in the Philippines are pushing to within 21 miles of a junction that would split the island of Mindanao in two, and mopping up of Japs on Luzon is gathering speed by the hour. The Levant crisis is still with us, getting worse, too. Dispatches from Damascus, the capital of Syria, say that strikes and riots are spreading throughout the country, protesting the presence of French troops. These reports say that business in Damascus and other towns has been paralyzed now by those strikes, and that the French troops have been confined to their barracks to keep them out of trouble. Students at Beirut are demonstrating, too, but these incidents are orderly. In Lebanon, the situation is quiet today. This crisis is built up on the attitude of the French that they must keep their fingers in Syria and Lebanon until the two countries are provided for by the New World Organization being formed at San Francisco. Syria and Lebanon are independent states now, as evidenced by the presence of their delegations at San Francisco, but France is still hanging on to the power granted it by the old League of Nations. There may be some new and more hopeful development of the situation tomorrow night when General de Gaulle takes to the Paris radio to address the French people. It's a different and a better story, though, in the dispute between the Allies and Marshal Tito over the occupation of Trieste. A new feeling of calm relaxation is reported to be spreading through the Adriatic port today, a feeling that has come since British Field Marshal Alexander arrived there. The Rome radio says that a communique is expected any hour now on a solution of the Trieste dispute. But American and British troops still occupy advanced positions in the area today above Trieste, and they probably will remain there until a settlement is reached. And back here in the United States, Congresswoman Clara Booth Luce of Connecticut had something to say about Trieste today. She said the Western Allies have decided to stop the aggression of communist states at Trieste, and she interprets the American stand on the question as an indication our government is determined to leave territorial decisions to the peace table. We have some more reports on Nazi submarines today, reports that indicate the Allies are getting tough about those U-boats that have yet to surrender. A dispatch from London says that 12 pirate German subs are being hunted down by American, British, and Canadian naval units combing every square mile of the Atlantic Ocean. And the commander of these Allied hunters now have orders to sink U-boats on sight and court-martial their officers unless they can prove they had not received the surrender orders. Here's the weather forecast for New York City and 50 miles around. This afternoon, sunny, windy, and warm with a high temperature of about 70 to 75 degrees. The present temperature here in Radio City is 64 degrees, humidity 51%. Tonight, clear and mild with a low of 50 degrees in the city and 45 in the suburbs. Tomorrow, sunny and warm. And now a spot summary. Winston Churchill resigned as Prime Minister of Britain today, but he won't be out of office very long. In fact, he's right back in. King George immediately asked Churchill to form a new administration, and this is expected to be done very soon. This new cabinet will replace Churchill's coalition government until after a general election on July 5th. When a new administration will be chosen by the British voters. Meanwhile, the British Labour Party, which forced Churchill's hand when it refused to remain inside the coalition cabinet, is meeting in Blackpool in England, getting set for the campaign leading up to the election, which promises to be a bitter one. Churchill, you know, is a member of the British Conservative Party. If this party is voted back in power, Churchill will be asked to become Prime Minister again. This is Don Goddard with your news at noon. I'll see you tomorrow. This is the National Broadcasting Company.